DCT Audio. The Art of Good Listening. This podcast contains frank discussions surrounding childhood sexual abuse, domestic violence, and drug addiction. Listener discretion is advised.
You're listening to a podcast on the Audio Boom Network. This is A Mindful Life with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the program. I do hope you enjoy it.
Mike and Danny, a very warm welcome to A Mindful Life. I'm delighted that you've been able to come and join us today. I think we've got three Manchester lads sat at the table, is that right? You're both from Manchester. Whereabouts are you from, Danny?
I'm living in Fallowfield at the moment.
Know it well.
Born in Clayton, but I'm living out in the hills now, in Rochdale.
Yeah, but you don't have a Rochdale accent.
No.
As with all my podcasts, I thought it'd be a good starting point, I suppose, to talk about our childhoods. It's the old saying, isn't it? You know, give me a boy till he's seven and I'll give you the man. So, Mike, can you just tell me a little bit about your childhood?
Yeah, do you know, it wasn't all bad. Grew up in Clayton with my mum and dad. Mum and dad had their own issues, but I never saw it. I never saw the issues between them. My dad ended up an alcoholic. There was domestic violence and stuff, and then my mum and dad ended up splitting up when I was about 8, maybe 9. And from there, we went into a place where it was like poverty, like real poverty. So towards the end of the 90s, it was rough. And then my mum ended up meeting a guy she went to school with. Yeah, he turned out to be my abuser.
Did your mum know what was going on?
No.
Because we used to get this a lot in the cults. The partner would know what was going on, but they would be the breadwinner. And so to report it would mean that everything would be lost. And you would think, well, how could she not report that? But she was doing it with the best intentions. It's kind of counterintuitive.
Before he came along, like literally, it was for tea, it was quick save, no frills hot dogs out of the tin, chopped up into little pieces, not cooked, and put in a bowl. And then afterwards for dessert, it was like a tin of no frills, quick save rice pudding. So it was hard times, you know what I mean? I remember being hungry, but then when he came around, because he had money, it's that thing, in it, you know, let's have a takeaway, let's do this, bringing a certain level of quality back to life that we'd kind of missed.
Probably buying your affection.
Grooming process. I know it's a bit of grooming process now, but I've resented my mum for so long about all of that. But what, you know, since I've started to sort of accept, heal and really recover from the inner depths of that trauma, I've realised that, you know, she was just as much a part of his grooming process as I was.
Yeah, good point. Danny, what about you? How was your childhood?
We didn't get off to a good start, to be honest with you. So my dad met my mum when my mum was in care, in a care home next door to where he was living. She got pregnant at 15, had me, couldn't look after me, left me in a house, and I got found like a few days later off my auntie. I think that's where my issues sort of started, with the attachment issues, abandonment issues, stuff like that, because she was never to be seen again for like a sort of 20-odd years. Grandparents got guardianship off me. My granddad on my mum's side sexually abused me till I was 10. Major impact on my education and my learning. Been to like 9 different primary schools. So every time I changed school, through my behaviour and through being passed around the family because they couldn't cope with me, I always missed out on the learning. So that created like sort of loads of like, there's a saying, isn't there? My behaviour spoke 1,000 words, and it did. And the entry wound for my behaviour was trauma, but it wasn't recognised, and it was just deemed as a little terror, should I say. And Sarah decided to put that mask on to like sort of keep me safe. And, you know, I was spoken to a guy who was like dead clever, some psychologist guy, when I was at this conference. And he was saying, like, we was talking about early intervention and stuff like that. And I was saying about at secondary school, because things went a bit haywire there. And he's like, no, no, no. He said, like, for you, he's like, 8 to 10. He said, that's when there should have been a flipping intervention. And I thought, God, you know what? He's right. Because what created after that Whereas someone with no boundaries, someone who wouldn't say no, someone with a lack of sense of identity, because my mum wasn't about, my dad wasn't about, didn't know who I was or who I belonged to. So I was seeking out from other people how to be, right, what I'd be like him, what I'd be like him, what I'd be like him. But the people I was seeking out to be was like the drug dealer off our estate, the guy who was violent, the guy who was committing crime. And I thought that's what it must mean to like sort of be a man, basically. So created this false identity that wasn't mine and became this kid who'd never say no because I wanted to fit in, wanted to be like, wanted to be loved. And I'd do anything, Danny do this, Danny do that, and I'd do it. You know, that led to me getting into loads of trouble. And at 15, getting groomed by a drug dealer from our local drug dealer from our area, who also sexually abused and raped me.
And isn't it strange? And we were talking previously, weren't we? And I was telling you about when I had some counselling, and a counsellor asked me, why did you join the police? Because I want to help people. She said, no, I'm not buying that. Why did you really want to join the police? And it was recognition. Because admittedly, my childhood was nowhere near as bad as yours, but there was that sense of abandonment, of needing to be loved.
It is strange, and it's like, it amazes me sometimes with the people that we come across, because you could, like you say, Mike, so like, you know, when you talk about A&E and, you know, there's somebody there with flipping one leg who's got poor hygiene and like being judged, and he's tried taking his life. Then you've got someone in the next cubicle who's in a suit, do you know what I mean, who's a workaholic, you know, from the outside looking in, everything's perfect.
Addiction takes many forms, doesn't it?
You know what though, when you've got that kind of obsession, it takes you away from being in your own head.
Yeah.
There's nothing worse than being trapped in your own head listening to yourself, because it is yourself. You know, I realize that I've been running all these years away from demons that had me when I was a kid. But what I didn't realize is I was trapped with them because I'd built a wall around us. Does that make sense? So yeah, I was trying to escape my own defense mechanisms.
Yes.
You know, yeah. So it's mad that, you know, we've all kind of been on a similar path.
It's strange, isn't it, when you're going on a journey, a personal journey, is that you forget that you're constantly changing anyway, regardless of what traumas you're carrying. But ultimately, the answer to the problem is you, because no one's coming to rescue you.
Some of the most passionate and driven, successful people that I've met in my life are people who can't sit with themselves. Do you know what I mean? And
being alone is not the same as lonely. It's true, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's true.
Right. Okay, Mike. So an unhappy childhood. So as a result of that, what sort of behaviours did that lead you into?
I was just... How can I say it? The teachers just regarded me to be a little dare, so to speak. There was a lot of attention-seeking behaviours. There was a lot of disruptive behaviours. You know, I wanted to be, looking back now, the class clown, so that I had attention from my peers.
To be liked.
Yeah, I wanted to be liked, but I was trying to stop myself from being bullied at the same time. Do you know what I mean? I was the fat ginger kid with Mercury trainers on, or Ascot trainers on, where everyone else is wearing Nike Air Max or Rockport boots, and nothing. I had the same jumper the end of year 8 that I started year 7 with. You know, it was poverty times. Like, I was a poor, poor kid. And yeah, it just, you know, I ended up going to a residential boarding school.
Your ultimate cry for help, which was ignored or dealt with the wrong way, was the fire.
Yeah, it was. But it's like, so I did disclose about the sexual abuse and stuff to the deputy headmistress at the time at the school that I was at. And when I say she took me in her office, and there was bruises on my body, but I'm not talking like superficial bruising. I'm talking like dark black purple bruising from where I'd been like severely hit, bite marks, scratch marks. And I told her everything, and, you know, about the sexual abuse and the beatings and being locked in a cupboard and all these different things. And she pulled the camera out, got somebody else in, stripped me down to my underpants and was taking pictures of me. And then she said, after she took a statement, she was like, right, you know, go to class. A social worker's going to come and see you before the end of school today. So I was walking away and I was like, wow, like that's all I needed to do. All I needed to do was just speak out and tell someone. I wasn't safe at that point because I was told at 3:30 when school finished to go to reception. And that same teacher that I'd disclosed to in the morning was stood in front of me with my abuser, telling him everything that I told her. And she was saying to both of us that we needed to go back to our home where he lived with us because a social worker was going to come to the house afterwards. So that was one mess up. But so you can imagine, she released me with him for him to take me home. And then we was living in Harper Hay at the time. And there's a big park sort of in Harper Hay and Blakelake called Boggart Hole Clough. And we had to walk through Boggart Hole Clough because it was the quickest jib. It was the quickest way to get back to the house. And as we're, you know, there's no zero conversation between us. Like, it's just quietness. But yeah, we're walking through Boggart Hole Clough and he just stops dead and he says to me, look over there to the right hand side. So we looked over and it was like all the autumny leaves had fell, but there was what looked like a partially dug grave there. Now, I know he'd not done it because he wasn't covered in dirt, but he basically turned around to me and said, you see that there? If you tell the social worker what's been going on, I'm going to slit your mum's throat. I'm going to bury her in there. I'm going to go to prison, talking about himself. And then I'm going to go into care and get raped and abused off all the older lads. So you can imagine, like, I got home. My mum's my protective factor. I told the social worker that I was lying about everything and there was no follow-up. But 5 or 6 months ago, I requested my social services record, which was a massive 3 pages long. And on the last page, Lorna, the social worker who came out to the house, went back to school to see who was the teacher that let me go with. And Mrs. final statement on that was she believed that I'd made up lies and accusations about because she thought I was jealous of the relationship that him and my mum had. So that was her final say. So for me, like, that was my cry for help there. I needed help. I thought I was going to be saved. I wasn't saved. And then it just sent me into a spiral. And I ended up setting a fire at school. I was walking to school one morning with my mate Martin. Obviously, by this time, I was smoking a lot of weed. And Martin had brought me lighter. And all I wanted to do was go in and have a joint behind the bike sheds before I went to the unit that I was in. I couldn't find a lighter. So there was a new building that had been built over the summer. I knew that in the new building, it was hollow under the stairs and everyone used to, you know, like just a blank space. And everyone used to store the bags under there between lessons. So I went rooting through everyone's bags to find a lighter. I found a lighter, but I didn't light a spliff. I set fire to everyone's bags.
Why do you think you did that?
Do you know what? I've asked myself that question so many times. And if I'm really, really honest, I can't remember. I just know that that's what I did. I don't remember the reasoning behind it. It wasn't to hurt anyone. I didn't want to hurt anyone. But either way, I did it. And prophecy was kind of right because he didn't go to jail and my mum didn't die, but I went into residential care where there was peer-on-peer abuse and I was raped and abused in there. You know, so for me, I shouldn't have. You ever seen Shawshank Redemption? That little chubby guy goes in there in the beginning. He's like, I want my mum, I shouldn't be here. I was that guy. Going in there, it was very, very institutionalized. And it was, I've never been to prison, but it was like a prison set up. So you go in, you've got your induction wing, all single room. But within the first week, 2 weeks, I saw people getting stabbed up in the showers, people getting battered in the showers. And that was a place where it's like, wait a minute, I'm vulnerable. I know I'm vulnerable, but I need to do one or two things. I need to just allow things to happen or I need to start fighting. And I'll be honest, it's that place that took every bit of fear out of me. I don't fear nothing because of that place.
How about you, Danny?
I think it was the impact of what had happened that flipping led me to the dark places, to be honest with you. Not having my mum about and not having my dad about, I think that had a big impact on me. Throw into mix the sexual abuse. And at first, the best thing that happened to me was a drug dealer befriended me. Because he gave me that stuff that my dad wasn't giving me. Because what he said to me was like, I know your dad's not about and all that, but don't worry, I'll look after you. So there's protection there. It's like I was his best friend. So he fulfilled all that. He fulfilled my basic needs financially, was giving me drugs, was buying me takeaways all the time, taking me to McDonald's, to Charcoal Pit, all those places. Do you know what I mean? That I hadn't flipping really experienced, even though my granddad had money and stuff like that. He didn't used to do like take me to takeaways. So he gave a kid everything what they needed. Do you know what I mean? Clothes, mobile phone, everything when mobile phones weren't about, status within the community because I was selling drugs for him. But before long, I was hooked on the drugs he was selling. And by the time I was 15 and a half, just coming up to 16, I had a full-blown habit on heroin and crack when I was still in school.
I think it's a familiar story, isn't it, with drug dealers that ultimately fall foul of their own product.
Mm. You know, I was doing that for him, and that went from 15 to 21, and he wasn't just outwardly sexually abusing me and raping me, he was spiking me and about 10 other lads as well, and doing all kinds to us when we was out cold, like proper out cold. And that lasted till I was 21. So I was like sort of, I was useful to people because I'd do anything, and there was nothing was off limits, if you know what I mean, in terms of committing crime or flipping, do take this here, take that there, hold this, hold that. I wouldn't have no problem. And taking the rap for people, all that kind of stuff. So I ended up getting in loads of trouble, you know, and ultimately how I got away from him is I went to prison when I was 21. I think I was really lucky because I was in the cons then. I'm glad I didn't go to young offenders, to be honest with you, because a lot of my mates who've been to young offenders, like what, same as what Mike's describing, are an absolute mess and are finished. I don't really know many people who've been to young offenders who were okay, to be honest with you.
It is an interesting thing with prison, isn't it? It's the old argument, you know, is prison there to punish or to rehabilitate? And to be honest with you, it's doing neither at the moment, in my opinion. And it just gives society a breathing space from the people that are inside, doesn't it? So there's nothing.
There was no rehabilitation when I was in prison. It was like, it was a way for me to meet other people and learn how to commit different crime and make new contacts and go get so deep into selling drugs and with people's names I won't flip in mention, you know, I was gone. And, you know, what that resulted in was me on the revolving door of prison, probation, rehab, detox, mental health units, drug services, A&E, round and round I flipping went for many years because nobody ever asked me why I was behaving the way I was behaving.
And I suppose it's all the more remarkable that you are where you are now, having, you know, overcome those hurdles. Now, just before we go on, I know, Mike, you ended up being a paedophile hunter of all things, and we talked about the reasons for doing that, but just tell me a little bit about that period of your life.
Yeah, it's a really interesting period. I'd never had justice, but by this time, I'd already had my son. So I think my son was about 7 at the time. My stepson was 6 or 7 as well. I had a little girl, and my little girl was about 18 months old. Now, I live in Rochdale. The three girls grooming scandal come out, and then the documentary, and, you know, the, I think it was a 2 or 3 part story into what happened. And I was watching it and I was thinking, for one, nobody likes paedophiles, but I especially don't like paedophiles. All this stuff is happening in Rochdale, round the corner from where I'm living. And initially, I'll be honest, I was thinking, and I've got a little girl. Even though I've been through sexual abuse myself, I didn't ever take into consideration the male side of it because it was, you know, it was three girls. And I was scrolling through Facebook a couple of days later, and it was the first time I'd ever seen paedophile hunters thing. And instantly, it was like the light bulb came on. It was like, that is a bit of me. But initially, it was the, I'm going to ruin a paedophile's life kind of thing. I'm going to really, really, like, give them what they deserve. I'm going to be to them what they were to me and other kids. I'm going to be the boogeyman that keeps them awake at night.
It was a vengeance, I suppose.
Yeah. It didn't end up like that. It really did not end up like that. You know, as soon as I stuck my head down that rabbit hole or opened Pandora's box, I had no idea that, you know, sexual predators were as rife online as they are. And it just grows. Even now, it just continues to grow and grow and grow. Like, it is dangerous online for kids.
What were you expecting to get out of being a paedophile hunter? Were the questions that you needed answering, or were you looking for answers about your own life?
See, this is the thing. I needed questions answering, but I didn't know what the questions were.
It's frustrating, that, isn't it?
I didn't know where I stood. I didn't know where I stood in society. I didn't know who I was meant to be. You know, I'd gone from being involved in sort of criminal endeavours when I was younger to now having a family and all this responsibility. And, you know, I wanted to kind of, I suppose in a way, that was another way of paying it forward.
Well, maybe it goes back to recognition.
Yeah.
When you was hunting Mike, you know, you didn't give your name.
Nah.
You always had your mask on. You was very kind of sort of, if you can be discreet about paedophile hunting, you was discreet about it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Without going into like sort of specific detail and stuff like that. But, you know, on the flip side of that, when you've been called to stings to do security for other teams, you've ended up, you know, there's a particular instance that I can think of where you ended up saving the guy and shield him when everyone was trying to knock 10 bells out of him.
Mm.
That was carnage.
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, when I was in the cops, we talked about it previously, didn't we? We would get, you know, a night note, somebody was in the traps for being apprehended by a paedophile hunting group, and my heart would sink. Not because a paedophile had been apprehended, but because the quality of evidence would vary quite a lot. And when they were good, they were very good. And the danger was that if the evidence wasn't so good, not so much the fact that the evidence wasn't there, but how it had been obtained or how it was collated would probably mean that we would have to let that person go without a charge, which is a scary thing because we're going on to safeguarding, aren't we? And that certainly, when I was a detective, the vast majority of my time was spent safeguarding not only victims, but suspects as well.
I didn't care what they were chatting to me about online. What I cared about is the immediate risk that they pose to children that they have access to. That was the real thing for me, the safeguarding concerns around that. So what I then did to make sure that everything was on point was I downloaded the Sex Offences Act 2003. And based on child sex offences, I put together a tick list, which would basically give me the chain of evidence that I needed in the way it was needed to be able to get a prosecution. And 375 prosecutions speaks for itself.
The salvation that you thought paedophile hunting would be for you ultimately nearly ended in you taking, well, you did try to take your own life.
Yeah, I did. I just never, you know, I thought that that's who I was. I thought that's who I was meant to be, you know? I thought that me doing all this amazing stuff and being this person, you know, at one point on my Facebook page, I'd like, I don't even know, I had about 200,000 followers, didn't I? And it was crazy because, you know, these 200,000 followers, a lot of them followed me from the beginning because when I say it blew up, it didn't just, you know, start and gradually eat like it because I did it a different way to everybody else. People think that when you've got that kind of platform that it's just all you're doing is stinging paedophiles, but you're dealing with real child cases where the people have been to the police and the police have done nothing. And that's no, you know, that's not me taking shots at the police. It's just where there's not enough evidence to be able to do anything or the grooming process hasn't quite gone as far, but the parents still want something doing about it. So you get them kind of cases coming through and then you get cases that have been NFA'd and the you know, the parents are annoyed because it's been NFA'd and then you spend time looking through that. So it led to me going into complete burnout. You know, me and my missus had drifted apart. Me and my family had drifted apart. I was on the road 7 days a week.
I fell into a similar trap, I suppose, in my work. And I made the mistake of thinking that I had to feel the trauma that the person I was supporting was feeling in order to be any good at my job. And now I realize that was crazy. And you're dealing with people who've got trauma. You're giving a bit of yourself to them.
Yeah.
And you're taking a bit of that person away with you. And perhaps the trauma and the cases that you were dealing with became too much?
Way too much. You know, some nights I'd be up until 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, marking off evidence and highlighting things and putting stickers here and, you know, what offence has been committed and how many times it's been committed. And, you know, it just become too much. I didn't realise how badly my mental health was getting. But yeah, 1st of January 2019, my missus found me hanging in the bedroom. I'd made my peace with God and that was me. And I can honestly say it haunts me to this day to even, and I know she'll listen to it, it haunts me. It haunts me to think that I put that beautiful, beautiful woman through what she had to find on that day. Like, that hurts. Mm. There's a lot of guilt and a lot of self-resentment there because, you know, we've been together 12 years in December. She's my best mate. Obviously, she's my best mate. She's pain in the bum, but she's
best mates usually.
Yeah, yeah. She's my best mate in the whole world. And it's, you know, it's still something that affects her. And I feel bad about that because...
Well, that's a trauma for her, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah, so it's like, it feels almost as if my trauma has now turned into second generation trauma because of the effect that that's had on her. She didn't know I'd been sexually abused. I didn't tell her up until probably about 4 years ago when it happened. But it's a gift and a curse because I genuinely believe that for where we're at now, we're stronger than we've ever been.
You know, you're two good mates, you're brothers from a different mother, but how did you end up meeting?
So obviously I was an expert. No, I'm joking. I was a paedophile hunter and Dan was doing his campaigning thing and doing stuff on Facebook around men, you know, speaking out about being sexually abused, sort of binning off that toxic masculinity thing and actually talking about it. And I'd, you know, because of toxic masculinity, I'd never, ever seen another man talking about being raped and abused. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Now, I don't know who sent the first message, but at the same time I was watching Dan was watching me thinking, I want to do what he's doing. So either way, we ended up, I think I sent the first message, but we ended up contacting each other. Honestly, like, that was one of the best things I ever did was reach out, because ultimately that then led to me going to Dan's peer support group where I was able to sort of take the first steps, baby steps, onto, you know, I think of it like a plane lining up to take off. You know, you've got to do all your taxiing and all your moving around the airfield to get into the right position. I genuinely feel at that time of my life, like that was the right time for me to step onto that road of recovery and sort of finding self. And yeah, that's exactly what happened.
It's a funny thing, recovery, isn't it? Because, and it's a dangerous thing because you start going into counselling and looking at your own journey. You know, you're opening up some pretty big boxes there full of pain. And if that's not dealt right and you're left with your pain that's now opened up without support, you know, I know people that have taken their own lives because they just can't cope with it because they weren't given the proper support once they'd started down that road.
This is this big thing we have. So we're not just talking about sexual abuse here, because we don't just deal with that stuff. It's about trauma. And it's like, you know, we'd said before, when myself and Mike run peer support groups, we've sat with people whose mum and dad have divorced and it's had a profound impact on them that they've gone down, you know, they've ended up as bad as, you know, somebody who's been sexually abused and raped as a kid. It's trauma's all flipping relative to yourself. But what we kind of say is if you're going to disclose about any kind of trauma, whatever that may be, it has to be an informed decision from yourself and not because somebody else thinks it's a good idea that you do it, because you're the one who puts your head down on your pillow at night on your own. Do you know what I mean? You're the one who's ultimately going to have to deal with it. So choose wisely, if possible. Obviously, things just come out sometimes or you get triggered or whatever. But if you're going to embark on this road to recovery, to kind of sort of getting your mental health in the best place that it can, and you know you've got stuff to deal with, do your research online, look at what support services are out there, if any, I don't, with recovery and trauma, I don't think one hat fits all. And if you tell somebody that there's a certain way that you can recover and that is the only way, then you're setting that person up to fail, because what if that doesn't work for them? Then, you know, people end up taking their lives because they think there's nothing out there.
Two things I learned from my counselling, which are truths, is that the trauma never leaves you. It will always be there, but it's how you deal with it.
Mm.
And the other thing was, and it was especially true for me at work, I mean, it wasn't just work. A few things came together all at once, a bereavement, memories of childhood and work, it all came as a perfect storm. The other thing is that you can't get well in the place that made you ill. Mm. So, you know, I was due for retirement anyway, so I thought, nah, time to go. And that's what I did, because I knew if I went back to that environment, it's not, the environment isn't going to change. So all I can do is take myself out of that environment.
But the interesting thing for me there, Dave, is like we spoke briefly about it before. It's like that must have had a profound effect on you, because that has been your identity for the past 25 years. You've got a warrant card. Oh, you stop, you here, get to the floor. Do you know what I mean? All that's gone. All that brotherhood's gone.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? So it's like, then you're like, I can only guess. I'm not, it's like a form of, you know, it's like when three worlds collide here, right? So, you know, if we talk about institutionalization, me in prison and all the other flipping services, you in Buglaughton Hall, you in the police, do you know what I mean? It's like we've all got a form of institutionalization and been, you know, been like sort of removed from it voluntary or through whatever reason.
It was. Being a cop for me was never about power over people.
Mm.
That wasn't, I genuinely wanted to help people, but I think that recognition thing was that, you know, it is a respected position in society.
Of course it is.
Even today with everything that's going on that you read in the news, you know, the vast majority of the public, I think, still respect the police and are the best advert that police can be are the people that work in it. And, you know, that interaction, that one-to-one, let just let our work speak for ourselves. Certainly when I left, and I knew it was going to happen, but it still
must have been a shock to the system.
Was it the pile-up? Did the pile-up happen?
No, it was just, I knew my identity was tied up in the police. And it's only, I mean, I've been out just over a year now, and it's only recently that I've started to think, who am I? And started to doubt, you know, who is Dave Thomas? I'm not sure I know.
Do you know what? The same happened to me, though. Obviously, it's a different thing with a paedophile on him, but because I'd never really had that self.
We couldn't even go to McDonald's or anywhere and they'd recognise him from his voice. We'd go somewhere, oh, it's my dark light. One day we'd just get it everywhere.
But, you know, it's that, innit? It's, I attach myself to that, even though that persona, that personality was hidden, you know, I wish I had a bat cave, mate. I was, you know, I've just turned it into a man cave now just to avoid the kids. But I did exactly the same as what you did. However, I really struggled with that disconnection and reconnecting into normal life. I've just done 4 years as a paedophile hunter. I've faced some of the most grisly people, you know yourself, like horrible, horrible, evil, disgusting people. I've now stopped and it's like, it's the train backing up kind of thing. You know, it's going 200 miles an hour, you slam the brakes on. If you've got, you know, a lot of weight behind it, it's all going to come piling up. And that's exactly what happened with me.
We found some videos from like about 4 or 5 years ago where I'm trying to convince him to stop paedophiling because it's going to kill him. It's like, nah, I'm sweet. Next thing you know, noose around the neck.
We were talking about our traumas, aren't we? And am I right in thinking you do a million pieces presentation? And the whole purpose is that, you know, ask me about my trauma. It's not going to trigger me into...
Mm. Yeah.
It's amazing how many people think that way.
So this is why. So basically, he was stopping paedophiling. I was doing some other work. And we're like, both met up with each other to tell each other, maybe stop doing what you're doing, we'll start something off together. Had a kebab, went to the city centre, went to the Arndale centre, said, let's see if the security will let us on top of the Arndale. A lot of people jump off there, didn't think he would, but he welcomed him in with open arms and took us right up to the top and left us. So we looked down, we was taking some pictures of the city. It was like, we had like a bit of a moment and was like, God, look how much carnage we've caused in this city over the years. with drug dealing, with committing crime, flooding places with drugs, ruining people's lives, basically. And there's this saying that this lady called Sarah, who we'll talk about shortly, taught us, and she was like, when she first said it, I took offence, to be honest. She went, hurt people, hurt people. I was like, what's she on about? But it's true. And that's what we was doing. And we had a bit of a moment and we was like, he was doing what he was doing with the paedophile hunting, and people like the police and other professionals wouldn't take him seriously or us seriously together. I was shouting and screaming at people with a megaphone outside Parliament, Speaker's Corner, cities up and down in the country about things being covered up and all that, and came across as absolutely crazy, basically. So I didn't particularly want to take me seriously either, because we was like, we was angry, we was aggressive. We wanted justice.
Militant, weren't we?
Militant. Militant. It was coming from an unapproachable place. People used to cross the road from us when we was criminals and selling drugs and stuff like that. Then we was in recovery and people were still crossing the road from us. Do you know what I mean? So it was like, how do we fix this? So it was like, right, let's stop taking a pop at people. Let's come up with a program which is trauma-informed, which inspires professionals to use professional curiosity. Let's call it a million pieces, because we won't break into a million pieces, just ask, and let's see where it go. But Mike went, right, first we need to get all these professionals following us. So we come up with a campaign called Follow Me, Our Kid, and started talking a bit about our experiences. And lo and behold, we're just about to, not like massive amounts, but we've got nearly 12,000 professionals following us on Twitter, and CEOs and heads of this and that. Once we got them following us, then we'd launch the program, Million Pieces. Just at that time, a professor called Dr. Nikki from UCLan got in touch with us, pulled us in for a brew, and she explained to us, that's when we got an understanding around what Mike was doing, because we're not professors or whatever, about the trauma reenactment. She taught us about that, and she taught us to be, don't hide your stories, be open and honest. We started doing that. Then a lady called Sarah Pritchard from Bernardo's got in touch with us and said, can you meet up with us?
We saw Bernardo's and we thought, God's sake, they're going to get us info.
But she wanted us to work in a flipping charity shop. Went and met her and she helped us. She said, let's come up with a trauma-informed masterclass session in partnership with Bernardo's. And we didn't think Bernardo's would give us the flipping time of day. But because we were so brutally honest about our past and what we'd been up to and everything, basically, and decided to be as open as possible and not hide anything. If people didn't like us, then that's your business. We don't really care. We're here to carry a message. Come up with some stuff with her. She took us on. She started mentoring us and kind of shown us how to, we didn't want to be professionals, but we needed to do things in a professional way, because basically we're just two scallies off the estate.
Speak for yourself.
Yes, you are, Mike. So she took us on as a mentor, and we started doing some stuff online with her, started doing some work with kids and stuff like that. And because of her faith in us, her taking a risk with us, because it was a big risk.
Yeah, massive.
We've just hit over 10,000 professionals. That's police, that's barristers, that's solicitors, that's judges, that is teachers.
Family courts.
Every person that you can think of who comes into contact with people who've experienced trauma, we've delivered training to, and it's people who've been getting in touch with us haven't been like sort of frontline workers. It's been CEOs of top organizations. You know, our ambassador is a guy who's an ex-copper, who's called Keith Fraser, who's now head of the Youth Justice Board, England and Wales. He's our ambassador. And we've got Catherine Randall, who's the deputy flipping safeguarding lead for the whole of England, who's our other ambassador. Now, these are people who would cross the road from us. But because we've been open and authentic and have got a strong message and the truth, we've caused a trauma. I'm not like to think it,
it's blowing our own trumpet. No more, it's a tsunami, mate.
We've caused a trauma-informed tsunami amongst professionals, and we're getting social workers ringing us. Can you come in and be consultants for us and advisors on this, that, the other? It's just been amazing, really, and a real privileged position to be in. And, you know, it's the power of one, isn't it, Mike?
Do you know what the beauty of it is? Is that we have grown into men not really having faith in inverted commas, the system. Yet we're doing what we're doing now in the way that we're doing it. And trust me, we don't turn up to these events wearing shirt and tie. And we turn up to one meeting and a conference in London.
The General Medical Council.
And we both had shorts and sliders on. and everyone else was suited and booted. Like, we don't we're not here to impress people. Like, we're here to speak our truth in our words. And it's that authenticity that people kind of like. They like that rawness to it. But what I've realized is that the more and deeper we go down this rabbit hole, what I'm actually realizing is that I'm having my faith restored in the system, because I'm seeing some real people at the top who genuinely care, and are not in their positions because it's a position, like you, not in their positions because it's a position of power, but they're in their positions because they want to make real change. And that's when you see the opposite side of the coin. You know, like police, for instance, I had nothing but beef with the police. I hated the police. But I hated the police because of some of the things I'd witnessed with people that were my associates and friends. But again, you know, it's. I think when you can see the opposite side of the coin and you're not looking at it through rose-tinted spectacles, you can actually see that there are people out there that care. And that humbles me, because I've now, you know, I've got a respect for the police. I've got a respect for the system, because I can see the people that are working behind the scenes. And they're the ones that are making the difference.
It's cultural change within the system. We can never change the system, but we can change the people within the system. And I think that's what we're achieving.
Yeah.
Now, I think as we come to the end of this podcast, the good work that you're doing, we've talked about our childhoods, haven't we? And that's where the real work is with kids, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think you're looking to get into schools and...
We're in the process
education.
Of officially starting something called Schools Like Us, but we're doing a lot of work in the Northeast around youth violence within schools, and that is just in the process of just exploding, and it's going to go absolutely crazy. We was in a school the other day, and the profound effects that those kids had on us was crazy. You know, we had one particular kid the other day. Mike did one school one day, then we did one together the next day. We've done a day's worth of filming with the kids that's in the videos about youth violence and knife crime and all that kind of stuff. But we actually got to teach a lesson, right, after we'd finished the filming, which turned into a peer support group with these kids.
And 20 of them on there.
About 20 kids, and they're like, what do you want to be? I want to be a drug dealer. And it's like, why? Because of the power and all that. And once we started delving into this kid's background and stuff like that.
Trauma.
The trauma and the needs not being met at home. And it was like, where are you getting these messages from? And not going off on one ear, but it was like, you know, who's your favourite kind of like sort of influencer? Andrew Tate. Mm-hmm. It's like, you mean the guy who's up for trafficking at the moment? Well, he's just been released, but he's up for trafficking and got all these kind of misogynistic views and all that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's great, but he's got some really good things to say. I said, but there's loads of other people who've got loads of good stuff to say and don't kind of behave like him, and they just would not have it. They just would not have it. Top G's, the top G. But the best thing about that is, and our thing is like, we're kind of sort of anti- not spending any time focusing on, but we're kind of trying to do exactly opposite of what he's doing and the messages what he's carrying, and we're having an opportunity to go into schools and do that.
The stuff you're doing as well, you can't expect to turn everybody, but those seeds are being planted and you don't know that.
And we've been invited back and the kids want us back.
Fantastic.
That's the beauty of it though. You know, you never truly know how many, I say this all the time, but you don't know how many people you're going to hit. You don't know how many people that's literally are going to embed that message as part of their ethos, as part of their understanding of the world. And I think that's, you know, the world's a confusing place at the minute. It's always been a confusing place to me. But I think in a time where there's so much uncertainty, especially after our journeys, the best thing about it is the only thing we can now leave is something positive. You know, there's nothing negative left for us to give. We've done it.
Well, they say, don't they, that one of the five pathways to well-being, the NHS, one of them is to give back, be altruistic.
We're doing all right. If I can, like, just say one thing from, like, sort of today and, like, sort of listening to our three experiences, we can recover and you can get well. But like you said, you can't delete it and it never goes away. But you can genuinely learn to live with what's happened and function and be happy. And I had a bit of a thing yesterday, Mike. So when I talk, I say, like, about I wanted to be normal and stuff like that. I wanted to be like the neighbour next door to me who's up at 9 o'clock mowing his flipping lawn. So listen to this.
Putting your garden furniture out.
Yesterday, I'm stood there, like, sort of mowing my lawn and stuff, going up and down, like, sort of mowing the back garden. And I thought, it might sound mad, but I thought, I've arrived. I'm him.
Yeah.
I'm him. I'm mowing my lawn. Yeah. I'm doing that stuff that it sounds a bit crazy, but I aspire to be like that, just normal, not like some Superman or millionaire or whatever. I just want to be cutting my grass, chilling without a care in the world. And that was me yesterday with the sun shining.
The white picket fence guy.
Mike and Danny, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, mate.
Honestly,
thank you. No, I've loved it. Yeah. Nice and chilled.